Welcome to Energy in Action. I'm your host, Marcy Young, and as a Mito patient myself, I appreciate you and the community you've helped us to build. This podcast honors the triumphs and struggles of patients and families affected by this disease and celebrates the work being done by doctors and researchers every day to make it a safer world for our people. We are a support group and a podcast focusing on all things related to mitochondrial disease. Welcome to another episode of Energy in Action. Today, I am joined by Dr. Melanie Gillingham, a woman that I have been looking forward to talking to for a very long time. I hear, you know, rumblings of how impactful these clinicians are for families in our community. And then when I get to talk to them myself, it feels really special. And then I get to share with our entire community how lovely she is and why she went into the work she's doing and all of the great things she's doing. So Dr. Melanie Gillingham works for the Oregon Health and Science University. She's a professor of molecular and medical genetics. She also trains future dietitians in the nutrition department at the university and the graduate department in a whole list of other things as well. But those are really the important ones. In addition, she's a great friend of Mito Action, and she works with FAOD families, not as a clinician, but in the research field. So welcome, Melanie. I hope I got at least most of that correct.
You did. It was great. Thanks, Marcy.
You are more than welcome. I wish my list of credentials was even a fraction as long, but I am so lucky that our community has someone like you that has really, you know, gotten herself so deep in this field to make life better for families in our community. So thank you.
You're welcome.
And we're excited to hear from you and to just hear your story and what all you do and why it makes you tick and all of that. So I think the best place to start is really at the beginning. How did your career path take you into this, you know, this specific type of research today?
That's a fun story. So I was a clinical dietitian. So I did a bachelor's and master's and internship and was working in a hospital, predominantly actually in adult critical care, and decided to go back and get my PhD at the University of Wisconsin. And actually, before classes started, I was invited to join the LEND program. And LEND stands for Leadership in Neurodevelopmental Leadership Education in Neurodevelopmental Diseases. And there are 50 different programs across the country. And it was originally founded by JFK when he was president because he had a sister with a neurodevelopmental disorder. And it's a really cool program that gets you involved in a whole variety of pediatric diseases, which was new to me. We rotate in feeding clinic and all kinds of different disorders. And I just really fell in love with biochemical genetics. And the first week was there, I met 18-month-old with LCHAD, who was just starting to see some pigments changes in her retina. Still am friends with this darling child who's now a grown adult today, and just really fell in love with the subject and the community and the families. And I've been studying LCHAD and fatty acid oxidation disorders ever since.
Wow. So these families really make a difference, you know, as a young student, you know, you can go in so many directions. But I have heard this from other folks in the field that, you know, it can really just take one special patient to kind of veer you in a particular direction.
Yeah, that's what happened for me. So
I love that you guys are still in touch and, you know, being close with those that have the condition probably better drive you in the right direction when it comes to research, right?
Absolutely. Because when we're doing even just, you know, studies at the bench and cells or, you know, basic science mice studies, I always see people's faces and family members in my head.
Yeah.
So it definitely changes the impact of the work that you're doing.
I mean, it's sometimes from the patient side, I sit there, you know, and I'm pouring my heart
to these, pouring my heart out to these doctors. And I like hearing that it can really be internalized, you know, and that there is that close relationship that can form, you know, and a want, a drive from your side to, you know, really research to do better and greater things out there and to create, right? Were you familiar at all with fatty acid oxidation disorders before you entered this LEAD program?
No. Well, not specifically. So I think in when you're getting a dietetics master's, becoming a dietitian, I probably had one class on inborn errors in metabolism, one lecture. And it was probably focused predominantly on PKU. So I knew what PKU was. And I knew the general concept of, you know, autosomal recessive inherited disorders that change metabolism. So I kind of knew that. But actually knowing for exactly what fatty acid oxidation disorders were, I did not until I started working in the biochemical genetics program at the Weizmann Center at Wisconsin as a student.
Wow, that's really interesting. So you don't see patients in a clinic, but you work with the FAOD families in your research. So can you tell us a little bit about the research you do?
Sure. Let's start with a little bit of the past research. So I kind of got started in the field actually in LCHAD retinopathy. And we did a series of studies when I was a student and a postdoc looking at DHA. So it's a long chain fish oil. And if DHA supplementation could slow down the progression of vision loss. And that moved on to looking at a variety of different things, like how could patients with fatty acid oxidation disorders exercise safely? Does taking MCT before exercise help? What about protein intake? They have more protein. Does that help with muscle mass and maybe could prevent some of the rhabdomyolysis that we see? And that led to the C7 study. So we looked at triheptanoin versus MCT in a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. And then beyond that, I've continued to work in the background on trying to understand and develop treatments for LCHAD retinopathy specifically. So we just finished a natural history study. So this was not an intervention trial. It's just following people with LCHAD forward in time to try to really characterize what's happening with their vision and their eyes. So that was sort of our latest study that we just completed.
Oh, interesting. So how many years were you following them?
Well, it was a 5-year study, but everybody came to either OHSU or Pittsburgh twice. So we saw them at baseline and then 2 years later. So it's really the first prospective data. We have a lot of retrospective studies that look back in time, but this is the first forward-looking study to really characterize how fast does vision change over time.
Okay. And what was like the average age of the person that...
So we enrolled 40 participants. Many are probably listening. And the participants, I really wanted to capture the whole spectrum of ages. So 2 was the youngest.
Okay.
And 36 was the oldest.
Wow.
And they were ranged in age across that spectrum. Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. So how quickly was their vision change? Like, what did you learn?
So I'm working on that, trying to publish that manuscript right now.
So you don't want to give it away, right?
No, I mean, I'd be happy to give it away. This is the audience that needs to hear. But it looks like, again, we're still in the process of analyzing it, but it looks like vision was pretty steady, didn't decline too much till later adolescence, puberty, which I've seen in retrospective studies as well. And at about 16 and older, you start seeing a very gradual decline. It does vary based on genotype, which shouldn't really surprise us, I suppose, that the genotype's playing a big role. And the decline is slow, but you can certainly see it in specific tests that we did. It seemed to be the electroretinogram, the ERG, which is not a fun test, but that test seemed to show differences a little bit easier than some of the other tests we did. We saw some differences in visual fields. And if you have ever gone to the ophthalmologist or the optometrist and they have you hold that button and then click it, if you see a little shaky bar in your eye, that test, we could kind of see some changes in that test. So we got some really beautiful data. It was so fun to meet all the families that came to Portland. And we really have some beautiful data, and we're working on trying to get that out for clinicians and ophthalmologists to have data on sort of rate of vision loss over time.
Wow. Sounds like a really big deal.
Yeah.
I hope that it can lend itself to, you know, as you're talking, you know, like the first comes research and then comes the data and then hopefully comes a treatment, right? So it all has to work together. And hopefully
yes.
This is the start of something really great.
It is. I mean, my goal really is to come up with a treatment for LCHAT uh-huh. retinopathy. So on the basic science side, we have several preclinical models. So we have some cells that we've taken skin fibroblasts of patients with LCHAD, differentiated them to stem cells, and then re-differentiated them to eye cells. So they're basically a eye cell in a dish, but it has LCHAD. And so we're studying what happens to those cells when you take away the glucose, for instance, and make them try to use fat for energy, trying different treatments in the cells. We also have a mouse. So we're working very hard on the basic science side to test and come up with good treatments that we can translate into the clinic side. And I'm hoping that this natural history data can serve as sort of the control group. The FDA has sort of indicated that in rare disease, if you have a really good natural history, that might be able to be a control group. So you wouldn't have to do sort of a randomized clinical trial. You could do a treatment trial and compare it to your natural history study.
And does it give you more energy, more hope after seeing like two treatments in the mitochondrial disease world be approved just in the last couple months?
Absolutely. It's so exciting. Yes. Yeah, it does give me hope. And yeah, I'm excited about it. I think we have a clear path and some definite possibilities for treatments. I can see it in the future. So I'm excited about that. I think the caution is, you know, research always takes long. I always want to say it's going to be shorter or faster, and it always takes longer than I think it's going to. It's just sort of a slow process. But I'm really, really looking forward to that time when I can come back and say, yes, we have a treatment.
right. Like, you know, it's a little discouraging seeing treatments for other types of mitochondrial disease and not my own. But obviously, I'm so happy for the community as a whole. And it means so much. Hopefully, everybody else is energized and pumped up, you know, in terms of those focusing on other types of mitochondrial disease. Hopefully, whatever they're working on, like you feel like you can, you know, make more headway because of what has just happened over the last short few months, right?
Right.
So
yeah,
good things are on the horizon. And I think that, you know, talking to someone like you on the podcast is always so important. I mean, patient stories are great, and, you know, learning about different nonprofits that can provide tools to our community is also so important. But then when I talk to someone like you, I want to like just kind of not shake the people listening, but I want to say, look, guys, maybe something's ahead for you too, you know?
Yes, I hope so.
Well, let's switch gears for a minute, because you do have a background in nutrition, and that is still a big part of the work you do. And I have felt like there's a bit of a lack of information when it comes to how do I form a healthy diet for myself in comparison to my contemporaries that don't have any health issues. And I get a lot of, you know, there's no information. My specialists, who are always so wonderful with as much information as possible when it comes to nutrition and dietetics, there's really not much to share. I've interviewed a few people on the podcast with some more like speculative ideas on nutrition, but I'm just so curious, like, why are things not as definitive as I want them to be?
That is an excellent question. So the field of, not surprisingly, the field of nutrition is so complex. So I'll try to tackle this question from a couple of different issues.
Okay.
So first of all, for whatever reason, primary mitochondria disorders has somehow skipped in the clinic over seeing the dietitian. And there has been historically a really, it's been really hard to study some of the nutritional supplements and that kind of thing in the community. And so we just haven't made a lot of headway of disease specific nutrition studies. They're just, like you said, there is a lack of information. Now, that being said, just because we haven't done an official trial in, you know, mitochondrial cocktails that is definitive or whatever other nutrition interventions you might want to consider, I think, you know, general nutrition guidelines, a healthy diet with a variety of foods that provides lots of micronutrients, vitamins, minerals, and a balance of calories and macronutrients makes sense, right? This is true for the general population. And so having the dietitians involved in metabolic clinic, seeing mito patients, I think would be hugely beneficial for the community. And we'll see if that translates into clinical practice in the future. On the other side, just in the general nutrition, not mitochondrial disorders, but general nutrition field, it's very interesting because there's a huge push right now and a lot of very big studies happening in what they call precision nutrition or personalized nutrition. And these studies are really looking at how every person responds a little bit different to diet. And so some of our large clinical trials have always taken, you know, thousands of patients and taken an average. But if you look at the average, you lose how some people had improvement on that diet and some people didn't. So let's say you're doing a study on heart disease and you're doing, you know, Mediterranean diet and you collect data on thousands of people. Well, the mean, yes, got better, but there was a range there. And so why is that? Why is there such variability in response to the same nutrition intervention? So there's a number of big studies that are going on right now that are doing deep phenotyping in just regular people, from genotypes to microbiome to, you know, food intake, all kinds of things, and trying to come up with the idea of we don't all respond to the same food the same way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the mitochondrial community, yes, we haven't done a good job of doing good nutrition science in that community. But quite frankly, in the general population, we're still just now getting into what's that variability and how do we decide, yes, you would, your personalized nutrition profile that would really benefit you is this. And we're not there yet in the general population.
Okay. So it's not just in the mitochondrial disease world where there's a lack of info. But I do agree with that. It's like you can have, you know, a few friends who are following the same eating plan, we'll call it, or diet style, right? And, you know, one seems to be losing a lot more weight than the rest, or one becomes more toned with a certain workout plan than others? And is it because of their diet as well? Like, there's so many factors that play into it. But I always just get nervous, like, should I be eating more frequently because of my condition? Should I have more protein than the average person? Like, there's all these little things. Should I have, you know, 2 more servings of vegetables a day? And I know it's not so black and white, but I wish it were. I wish that I could make things better for myself with something as easy as, you know, changing my diet. But I agree with you. I think that, you know, just following a clean, healthy eating plan, you know, with a variety of foods and hitting on all the nutrients and the vitamins. But I just, you know, is vitamin A more important? It's so hard to know, right?
It is. And again, I would say that we're still struggling with all of those same questions
in the general population. Yeah. So I guess I'll just have to wait on that, right? Like everything else. Yeah. But that's okay. You know, you've done such a variety of work over the course of your career. Would you be willing to share with us just like a beautiful patient story that really like inspired you or made you feel like more passionate about the work that you're doing? It's clear from doing this podcast
for almost 3 years that the families you work with absolutely love you. So I'm hoping that, you know, from your side, I'd love to hear something that's really been inspiring for you.
Wow, I could pick from so many. So one patient story that was really inspiring for me. Well, let's see. How would I pick one? So again, I've done a lot of work with fatty acid oxidation disorders in general, but probably more specifically in LCHAD. So I do remember a couple of patients, but one in particular comes to mind, who after puberty really started struggling with the peripheral neuropathy that can happen in LCHAD and had become sort of wheelchair bound, was standing and transferring, but not really walking. And spent a lot of time just, you know, on the phone. This patient was not in Oregon, but I was communicating with them from a distance. And after a period of time, you know, and I'd love to say, you know, we were working on diet and how to up MCT oil and get some carnitine and lower fat and doing all the treatments that we thought might help. And after a period of time, he just got up and started walking again. I was amazed. And this has happened a couple of times. I was just like, wow. And I talked to a neurologist about it. And I was like, can this happen? And the neurologist is like, well, that doesn't happen. I'm like, well, it just did.
Oh my gosh.
It did. And I'd love to say that it was something that, you know, some more treatment, but I don't think so. I just think that now that I've seen it happen a couple of times, I think the peripheral neuropathy waxes and wanes. It's still a mystery to me. I don't understand exactly why, but I'd love to figure out. I mean, that's just phenomenal that it just got better and he got back to walking. So that was,
oh my gosh,
one of those super exciting things. You know, it doesn't go away. The neuropathy and is still there, but it certainly waxes and wanes. And I've seen it in a few other patients who've really, really struggled, and then it's gotten better. So I think there's so much to learn there, just about nerves and regeneration of nerves and motor sensory neuropathy. But I think about it a lot, but I still haven't come up with the best study or how do we investigate this to figure out what's going on. But it was really fun to get the call and say, yeah, I felt stronger and I started walking again.
It sounds like something out of like a fictional movie.
No, doesn't it?
That's really incredible. I'm sure it really makes the work you do, like, you know, it pumps you, like it makes you want to do that for someone else, right?
Right.
That's cool. Thank you for sharing that. So what do you think our mitochondrial disease community should know about you?
Well, they probably already know this because I probably respond to emails all the time. I am definitely a workaholic. I tend to work a lot, but I'm also very singularly focused. My hobbies are cooking. I love to cook. And I am always looking at the next, you know, trying to do a lot of vegetarian plant-based meals and hunting new cookbooks. So that's one of my big favorites. At our last Mito Action meeting for fatty acid oxidation disorders, we had Glenn Chef give a talk that was just fabulous. So I've been doing some dives on cooking techniques that use less oil and stir frying without a lot of oil. So it's been kind of fun to explore new food things together with the community. So that's sort of one of my big hobbies. I love to vacation in Hawaii when I can. In February in Portland, it gets pretty dark and dreary. So we like to go to the sunshine for a little bit. Yeah. And it's also when the whales are there, so it's fun to watch the whales.
Oh, that's really cool.
Yeah, jumping in the ocean.
Yeah, being on the West Coast, you're a lot closer to Hawaii than, you know, me in Cleveland.
Yes, it's a nice short, like a much bigger. Nice short one flight and you're there. So
wow. Yeah.
So I guess those are kind of my passion things.
So where do you hope your research from today goes in the next year? If we were to sit down together in a year, what would you have hoped to have achieved?
That's a good question. A year is a short time frame, but...
Okay, so should we say 3 years?
Yeah, maybe 3 years. So there's a couple of things. Yeah, there's a couple of things I think are exciting on the horizon. So Jerry Vockley at Pittsburgh and I and some other investigators, Duke, Colorado, UCLA, we submitted a rare disease consortium for fatty acid oxidation disorders. And I'm really hoping we get to do that. And so I'd like to see if we could establish a consortia for all fatty acid oxidation disorders where we would follow a cohort of participants forward in time and characterize how frequently do we see rhabdomyolysis? How frequently do you see metabolic decompensation and hospitalizations? Characterize from the patient's perspective, what are the most important and life altering complications that they struggle with on a day-to-day basis? Get a better handle on what nutrition and supplements people are using, because I don't think that's well described. So I think we could gather a ton of information and partner with the community to really provide, again, sort of that natural history. This is where we are. And then it can be a springboard for how do we move forward with treatments. And that's been a problem in the field, because other pharmaceutical companies and people who've wanted to develop treatments, they don't have a good baseline as to what's going on. And so therefore, it's hard to determine what the endpoints for that clinical trial are going to be. And some companies have failed because we haven't had that baseline knowledge. So I'm excited about that possibility. I'm very excited about our LCHAD retinopathy work. And I do hope to submit a grant for an intervention trial in the near future. And so I'd like to see us move towards a treatment type of trial in the next 3 years. Again, as I mentioned earlier, I always think it's going to go faster than it really does. But I would love to see that would happen in a short period of time. So we have some ideas on how to propose a treatment trial and see if we could get that funded. And then, you know, just other things that we've been working on, a lot of cardiac things. We're very interested in sort of the effects on the heart for mitochondrial disease, fatty acid oxidation, but also mitochondrial disease in general. So we have some ideas of both treatment or natural history studies in patients, but also some basic science work to do at the bench to try to come up with some and better understanding of what happens to the heart when your mitochondria aren't working so well, and what kind of interventions we might do that would preserve cardiac function.
Oh, wow.
In that case. Yeah. Huh. So those are sort of my big dreams for the next 3 years.
I would say those are big goals, but you know, everything I know about you and what I've learned about you, I don't, like, you're gonna get there. So I think that's exciting. And they're all so important. So this consortia, the first one you described, so if this was approved, it would be easier because you would be able to share data and analyze it together?
It would, but it would also provide a lot of funding. So the consortia are, for instance, there's a mitochondrial consortia. There has been a mitochondria, primary mitochondrial disorders consortia. There's one for PKU. There's several of them for different urea cycle disorders. This would be the first one for fatty acid oxidation disorders. So it would provide, it would infuse a bunch of funds for us to be able to do that work. Uh-huh. And yes, we can share. We would create publicly available, obviously de-identified, so we preserve people's privacy, but it would be data that other researchers could investigate. We could infuse the entire field with better understanding of just sort of what's happening. I think that would really springboard treatments for the future.
For sure. Wow. Okay. Well, 3 years from right now, November 2028, let's sit down together and see what you've come up with, right?
Okay, sounds good.
I really give you so much credit. There's, you know, there's so much challenge in this world, and you are fighting through it. And I, on behalf of our community, I really thank you.
Thank you. It's really a joy to go to work here today. So
I really like hearing that. There's so many people that don't feel that way in a variety of industries, right? So,
right.
You know, knowing that the person that is making headway, or a person who is making headway in our disease community, has that energy is fantastic. So thank you so much. Thank you for spending time talking to us and letting us learn from you and hearing that there are things on the horizon, because I do think that's really important for our community to hear, even when sometimes it feels like there isn't.
I am happy to do so. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And I will meet you back here in 3 years. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. I encourage you to browse other Energy in Action podcast episodes. I am so inspired by the resilience of those in previous episodes, and I know you will be too.